On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Todd Haynes and Natasha Kennedy about the Fat Cat series from Lexham Press. So this is a lot of fun and unique because we're talking about children's literature and how it functions to teach and to train, and how it might function to teach and to train even adults. What do kids gain from memorizing and confessing words that they might not yet understand? What role do theologians like Luther play in this series? And is it a Second Commandment violation to have an image of Jesus on a book like this, and much, much more? As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. We're a podcast that is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And in thinking seriously, we've endeavored and attempted to cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. So what that basically means is that we talk about a lot of serious topics, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. We think that it matters how we interact with other people. We should treat them kindly, respectfully, charitably, but that doesn't negate our ability or the necessity even of interacting critically and sharply when necessary. We think that you can couple these two things together without sort of splitting out what it looks like to be a Christian and to carry yourself with moral virtue and character. We think these things go together. Now, on today's episode, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. Todd Haynes, who you may know from a previous episode with us and the work that he does at Lexham Press, as well as somebody who might be new to you in Natasha Kennedy and their work on the Fat Cat series of books for children. So this is actually probably going to be one of our most relevant episodes that we've ever done. And that's just because I know a lot of people who listen to our stuff are either fathers or mothers of young children, or their grandparents of young great-grandchildren. And so the question will continually come up of how is it that we can teach them and train them and train them in the fear of the Lord? What does that look like for me? And even in a group chat of mine recently, I had somebody reach out and say, hey, do you guys struggle with family worship where it's just a struggle? You know, there's a lot of challenges that come with having little children and trying to teach them properly. And so these sort of questions just come up all the time. So this is going to be a really, really fun episode as well, because I've benefited and enjoyed from these books myself, and so have my kids, teaching them the Apostles' Creed and various things. I think it's a lot of fun. So before we jump in, Todd, tell me a little bit about yourself. We'll start with you, and then we'll go to Natasha.
Nice. Well, thanks for having us on, Jordan. I'm very curious, though, also, does your group chat, is it a named chat?
Well, sort of, kind of. We call it the Slack because that's what we use for the chat, where there's multiple chats of large groups and even small groups, but that's about as name conventional as we get.
I see. Right. I just, you know, there's the two types of texters, the namers of group chats and those who don't answer. All right. Well, so I'm Todd Haynes. I am the associate publisher of Acquisitions and Development at Lexham Press. I also acquire books and things. My jam is particularly theology. I'm a historical theologian by training. I also acquire a lot of pastor books, and then I'm thinking a lot of books that are going to help everyday Christian folks. And that's part of the Fat Cat story. But I dabble with some of the biblical studies, even though I spent a lot of my time at school raving against biblical studies. I still consider some biblical scholars my friends, and so there's always interesting things to get out of them too. This will probably come out, but I am a Luther scholar by training. That's my thing, is Luther and his preaching, and I live in the Pacific Northwest, a place called Bellingham, Washington. Have two children, a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, and my wife runs a preschool.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me on here. I'm Natasha Kennedy. I'm also in the Seattle area, kind of an hour south of Todd. I'm a author and illustrator. I like to dabble in both worlds. I'm someone who you can find just always finding every spare moment to either write or draw something. And I'm all about dressing truth up in beautiful clothing and delivering it in unique ways. I have four kids that I homeschool, and I do it with a myriad of health issues that keep me from eating food. And so I have a unique way of tackling life. And art plays a really big role in that, a really big role in bringing beauty into a hard situation. So all that said, I'm a very, very happy person. And I absolutely love doing these Fat Cat Books with Tawn. It's kind of a big highlight of my life.
Natasha, you said that you love beauty and art. So does that mean that you're not allowed to be a Protestant?
Yes, I'm Anglican. So, you know, we find a way to get everything in there.
Isn't that so true? Now, when we talk about Fat Cat, what are we talking about? For those who aren't familiar with it, like, give me the lay of the land. What is it? What's its purpose? Maybe what inspired it? How does this compare to other titles that are similar to this? Those sort of things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I was just listening to one of the things that we do. I always feel like we have to do this part, but I always feel like we say the same thing, which is probably fine and good. But you know how that is. So anyway, get a little bit of anxiety about it. But so the Fat Cat moniker, I'll just say what that is. I guess maybe we do need the buildup. So the story behind the Fat Cat series is that, yeah, Lexham is, we didn't do kids' books. But the thing that Lexham is concerned about is, what does it look like to have books for pastors and church leaders, and frankly, seminary professors? In what does it look like to make books about the Christian faith for people who are not well catechized? So there's several generations now of uncatechized Americans. We're going on, I guess, our fourth. Although maybe there's hope, maybe those things are changing. But that's really the question that Lexham has had. What does it look like to teach a person to fish instead of just give them the answers? And that's often what books... the expectation in Christian books is, it's just going to give me all the answers. I want a really big book, answer all my questions. And so Lexham started on this path of bringing back the catechism. And the catechism, that's a phrase that has sort of three reference in the way that often it can just be a general thing. It doesn't have to be a Christian thing. It's just questions and answers. The other thing that you'll see is a commentary on what's called the catechism itself. So that's usually the thing that Christians are familiar with. Things like Westminster, Heidelberg, Luther's Small Catechism, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the London Baptist one that I'm not thinking of, anyway, 1689 or whatever, which is Westminster, just slightly changed. And those things, they all answer questions about what the church has historically called the Catechism, which is the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, and the Lord's Prayer. This is the structure of teaching someone what it is to be a Christian and how to find their way around in the Bible. And so Lexham has found ways to deploy that in a lot of different books, particularly the Christian Essentials, which are little books for normal church people to walk through this. And the idea is not just to dumb down these things, to have some expert dumb it down for normal church people. Church people are the experts in the Christian faith, because Christian faith isn't merely cognition. And so part of that story has been to do kids' books, because there are several seams in a person's life when I think they're very open to church things. Even somebody that's sort of grown up in the church, you see this natural ebb and flow of kind of coming in and out. College sometimes is at least for my generation, was a time that you'd see people kind of pull back, and then they get married and they're kind of thinking about church again. And when they have kids, that's a moment that it's like, oh, church is important. We need to go do this thing. But they don't know how to talk to their children about the Christian faith. They don't necessarily, and they're worried about reading the Bible. It brings up all this guilt, like this is this thing that we should have been doing. Kind of like you were saying earlier, Jordan, about the family worship. There's just a lot of guilt that people experience because we have this vision of what the Christian life looks like. So the goal of the Fat Cat books was to speak to parents and those who care for children, that's saying, don't be anxious about having all of the answers. The key thing is get these kids these texts, And, you know, we have these wonderful authors, Ben Myers and Harold Sankweil, and they're going to tell you enough to sort of start down this journey. They're not going to tell you everything in these texts, but they're going to give you enough to love these texts and to go and wander. So that's the backstory there. How we came to the name Fat Cat has to do with, well, my wife and I, we had a very fat cat named Earl, which is spelled like squirrel, but without SQ. Don't remember why we named him this, but when we adopted this little cat in Chicago, they looked at us like we were crazy, which is totally fair. But Earl, Tasha had been working on some concept art for children's stuff, and she cast Earl the cat in the style of Ivan Earl, the Disney artist, and had jokingly put Fat Cat on there. And we were like, oh, you know, this is kind of too silly for all this. But Tasha's husband, Lindsay, had pointed out, no, it's perfect because there's not a replacement word for catechism. You know, you have to say the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, or catechism. And so that's a scary word that people don't know and they're not used to. And so here the phrase Fat Cat makes it kind of silly and approachable. Here's this ancient thing that's big but small and has all this depth, and you're not going to get to the bottom of it. So Fat Cat became sort of the stand-in for what we were up to doing in this. And he finds his way on all the pages. He's padding around in there. And we've given him a whole cast of character friends now. Anyway, Tasha can say more about that. Yeah, that was the danger. I had this professor at TED's that he's like, you always got to be careful about background chapters. Because sometimes people go down, they're like, down to the background chapter. And they never come back up. So I think I came back up with Fat Cat. But I'll stop.
So Natasha, tell me a little bit more about on your side, how that story develops, how that grows, and your vision really for the series and for the individual books and how you've just developed it in general.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about what you were saying about us having a serious faith. And it makes me think of one of my favorite authors, Terry Pratchett. He had this thing he said about, he writes comedy books in a fantasy, ridiculous fantasy world. And he has this thing that he would say that funny is not the same thing as silly, where he would actually, his books are funny and he has you like crying, laughing, but it's, you end up full on real crying because there's so much depth in his writing. And he puts this levity onto, he mixes like levity with depth, and it kind of like joins into this really wonderful experience. There's a little plug for Terry Pratchett. And I feel like Fat Cat, we kind of like wanted that balance of it feels like you're laughing at, you know, this silly like raccoon in the corner, you know, chasing after Fat Cat, or Fat Cat's trying to steal one of the fish from the five loaves and three fish thing. You know, there's funny stuff in it, but at the same time, we wanted there to be real depth and real seriousness to it. Like, you know, when we portray the crucifixion, it's serious and solemn, and we're letting the kids see some blood. We're letting them see the nails. We're letting them connect with the how deep and serious our faith really is. And that's kind of the vision with the art, was like, how can we make this both approachable for kids, something really fun, and yet also make it feel classic and like you're looking at something that's, yeah, taking itself seriously, something that's actually reverent. So we kind of like Todd said, I pulled from a lot of the old Disney art, like Sleeping Beauty. If you look at the backgrounds in Sleeping Beauty, your jaw's just going to drop and you'll be like, oh my gosh, this is beautiful. And then also looking at iconography and the way they do placement and symbolism and expression, and the use of colors, kind of pulling from these different worlds to create an art style that it feels like a little kid could have fun just looking at animals, and a parent could, you know, cry, you know, and because they're actually like connecting with the deeper truth. So yeah, we kind of, together with the you know, Ben Myers and Harold writing like really beautiful text, and us, but also us wanting to stick to the actual lines of, you know, the Apostles' Creed, Ten Commandments, Lord's Prayer, kind of giving kids and families a resource that's both classic, but also like the kids really want to pick up a Fat Cat book. They want to find out where's Fat Cat on this page. And Wormy, he's like the challenge one, you know, you can, in some of the later books, like where's Wormy? He's hard because he's really small. So yeah, that's kind of our vision for Fat Cat.
Yeah, my kids actually really love the book. So I really appreciate you all doing, putting in all the work on this and making a reality, that because there's a lot of religious books out there. I mean, I think of, my wife loves to buy children's books for my kids. So, I mean, we've got huge amounts of books for them, library to develop interest and passion in reading. So there's a lot of books that they simply don't even look at. And that ends up being mostly a lot of the religious books, you know. There's a lot of them out there that just aren't interesting and aren't well done, but these are an exception for them where they actually really enjoy reading them and really enjoy finding the Fat Cat. Now, here's the question that I think is probably burning in a significant number of our listeners' minds, because a lot of our listeners are in the sort of Reformed context where, at the very minimum, images or pictures of Jesus make them uncomfortable. Now, I think it's probably a decent split on whether they think it's actually a violation of the Second Commandment to make an image of Jesus versus an image of something like the Father, where they would say, you know, that pretty universally, I think, against that. But when it comes to images of Jesus, I mean, if you look on the internet, I think the common trope is, you know, to put 2CV on anything that has an image of Jesus. And so here, I mean, you've got images of Jesus throughout all of these books. So what in your mind is sort of like the framework behind thinking through why it's okay to display him versus why it's not okay, or why someone might think it's not okay and why they should think it's okay? So, you know, my own personal opinion is I think it's okay there's lots of funny, you know, anecdotes on this, and I won't really get into them because I want to hear your answer for this. But I understand the uncomfortability that many of others have. And I've gone through probably portions of my life where I have said that that is unacceptable. So tell me more about it and why you think it is totally cool, or at least done in the right way, it's okay to do it.
Yeah, I feel like with one of these things, yeah, you're taking a stance as soon as you make a kid's book about Jesus. You're taking the stance. And so that's like kind of like, yeah, I mean, if that's what you hold, then this book's going to be a real stumbling block for you. I respect people with different theology to me. You know, we were going to hop on a podcast at one point and they ended up saying, oh, sorry, we didn't realize that Jesus was depicted. We can't do this podcast interview. And yeah, I was a little miffed, but then it was like, yeah, I respect that. You know, like you've got to do what you got to do. But I feel like for us, like if we've made the choice, you know, I bet Todd will have some really good things to say. I'll just speak from an artistic point of view. Once we know what choice we've made, that we're depicting Jesus, then we're going to put him everywhere. Mm-hmm. We're going to go all out. He's going to be on every page. And you know, we're not saying that we're worshiping this image. That's kind of the classic rebuttal against that, but I don't really feel the need to argue since we made a stance. You know, it's like we either disagree or we don't agree. But my kind of defense of being passionate about children seeing Jesus is that we're teaching our kids about a savior who became a human. He like broke the second commandment himself, you know, not really, but by coming and becoming a person that you could walk up and see on the block. He was someone that said, let the little children come to me. Like, keep them away. Let them come to me. You know, he's someone who is, he became incarnate. He became someone who you could draw a picture of if you saw him. He became someone who you would remember his face if you had met him. And so for me, it's all about what message are we giving the children about Jesus when they interact with him in a book. And to me, the message is he came to be among you as one of you. He came as human. He came like, you know, like a child sitting on Jesus' lap would be a child sitting on their dad's lap. Like he came that, he became that real and that accessible. And so by depicting him, it gives us an opportunity to teach more theology through the expressions of his face, through his placement on the page. yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. The Westminster 109 hardcore types. It's like a lifestyle choice, you know? I think those folks, they just have to know. They've chosen a way, and it is different than a lot of others. I know some Presbyterian types that are that are hardcore Westminster 109, can't depict Jesus, and they can be really kind about it. They're just like, oh, we just think differently. The ones that I find a little harder are the people that, yeah, like, I mean, it's just the internet, but sometimes when our product page stuff goes up and somebody will be like, oh, this is too bad you didn't actually read the Ten Commandments. And it's like, look, you have a different view and that's fine. But I mean, like with children's things, it is a very practical hindrance. So, I mean, this goes hard, I guess, but all I can do is go back and think about the ecumenical councils when they talked about the iconoclasts. And the question at stake is, if Jesus is human, all the stuff that humans do and we can do with humans can be done with Jesus. And so you can depict a human, you can depict Jesus. And that's a beautiful tradition that all cultures are saying Jesus does come to us. And so you see Jesus depicted in many different ways, that he's part of the family. And there's a real beauty to that. And just practical importance that if Jesus has come near in his word, we need to be able to talk about him. And with children, we show. We're not saying this is exactly what Jesus looked like, but when we're talking about these stories, here's the main character, here's the person. And you know, sometimes I see they changed movement on this, but the Kevin DeYoung kids book, originally they didn't depict Jesus, that Crossway book, and then later they decided to, and it was interesting to see that first one. Sorry, I have a little cough. That first one, the emphasis seemed all wrong. Because you're like, here's this book that we're saying it's all about Jesus, but where is he? And so some of the stories ended up coming across very, like, Marian was really interesting. But I think ultimately it does come back to this simple thing that if God took on flesh, we can talk about him. I think about this this is a rabbit trail, but I've been thinking about this with some of the people that are concerned about masculine language for God. And so they'll avoid pronouns for God. A natural outcome of the incarnation is that we can talk about God. And there is nothing in the English language that you don't use a pronoun for. There is no such thing. And anyway, that's related but different. I guess I just wanted to try to sort of reframe it. That sometimes I think, like, if we're really going to have the argument about can we depict Jesus, none of us are saying we're worshiping this image. This is a teaching moment, and we're depicting Jesus because he became man.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me if we take this paradigm to its fullest extent, then we have to say that even if Jesus dies and resurrects after that, if Peter or the other apostles have an image of Jesus, a memory of Jesus in their minds, they're committing a second commandment violation. Or if you want to take the paradigm fully to its extent again, if you have a picture of a lamb, or a picture of a dove used in a religious context, again, that is another second commandment violation.
Well, and then that's with the Apostles' Creed book. The one that was the most difficult is depicting the Father. And so, I mean, if you go and look at that image, it was done very carefully. Like, I don't think it's been particularly helpful to portray the Father as a dude with a beard. That it's great art or whatever, but I don't know that that's really been great. And so we tried to go back to that verse that he dwells in inapproachable light. And so that's what Tasha tried to depict there on God the Father Almighty. And you do get into some hard spatial things eventually. So then that's like when Jesus ascends to the right hand of the Father, we have Jesus on that throne. But how do you do this where you're depicting Trinitarian truths without being like, oh, there's the three gods? So it was hard.
Yeah, no, totally. So when we think about this book in the series and its function as sort of a catechesis of sorts, what is the value of doing that when our children may not even understand most or even all of the concepts there?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. I mean, there's something funny to me about Christian stuff where people ask these kinds of questions. These are sincere, true questions that people ask all the time. Yeah, why am I teaching my kids stuff that they don't understand? Or like in our Christmas book, we didn't stop at Jesus being born. We went all the way to him being crucified and risen again. And some people would be like, well, kids don't understand what crucifixion or resurrection is. Like, well, of course they don't. But they also don't understand what birth is. They don't understand any of these things. And we don't have that anxiety when we talk to kids about food or just talking to them, asking them how they're doing. People do this with babies. People talk to children in utero. You know, nobody is thinking, well, yeah, but can they actually understand what I'm talking about? Or maybe they are, but I mean, we understand that we're communicating more than cognition. And that's an important analogy for the life of faith. That if we're going to give people a life of faith in the Bible, we have to handle them at least that same way. And part of that is, yep, we're going to give you these big words, and some of them you aren't going to know. But just like other things, you learn them by speaking. And so something that has been around the last few generations is this idea of trying to teach kids concepts before words. We give you the concept so you can have the word. But historically, the way that the world has worked is that the word brings the concept. And if anything is that way, Christianity is especially that way, because we're saying that God's word does what it says. God speaks the world into existence. And so his word is really powerful. And that means that it's going to do all sorts of things we don't understand. Psalm 126 is really interesting here. Those who sow in tears reap with joy. There's something about when we're sowing the seeds of God's word, we don't know what's happening. This isn't a word that we control or that we direct. So it's a word that we faithfully teach and confess. And so that's the use of these books, is that you're starting with something very small. Three texts that a child really can master. And that used to be the expectation. You know, medieval period, you go to school, a four-year-old is going to be expected to know these texts. And anyway, so you give them these three texts, and then children can find their way around in the Bible. They can find their way around in church service, where they're making these connections. I mean, I've heard my own children, what was it one day, they were reporting about something that happened at school. They're like, oh yeah, so-and-so was coveting. And so you start to see they're taking the Ten Commandments and finding it in their lives. But I guess the other part of this, and then let's see what Tasha thinks too, of course, is that historical pedagogy is you teach them the words, memorize the words, don't worry what it means. Then you teach them the meaning, memorize the meaning, and then you can go and you have mastery of the subject. Now you can talk about it and find your way around and say it in different ways. And that really is a great progression that bears out. If you try it with your kids, you'll see it works. But handing it over to Tasha.
Yeah, I've heard it be described as giving your kids clothes that look too big, but they're big enough to grow into. Was it Hal that said that?
Yeah, that's a classic Halism.
Yeah, I love it. It gives you such an instant visual where they don't need to understand yet. They don't need to fit the clothes yet, but they're wearing them. And the older they get, the more the clothes will, you know, what will fit. Another way of thinking about it is, you know, you go back to creation, and what God does as he makes the world is he begins to separate things and name things. And as he gives Adam authority on the earth, he gives him the authority to name things. And I feel like that's what the Ten Commandments, Lord's Prayer, and Apostles' Creed does for our faith, is it gives you a name, and then you start understanding what that name means. This is coveting. And now as we go through life, we're going to be able to say, like, hey, that right there, that feeling you have, that's actually called coveting, you know, wanting something that God has not given you. And so I feel like that's what this catechism does. And like Todd said earlier, like, we're giving parents words to give to their children. Because even the parents, we didn't have, you know, I'm a millennial. I didn't have this. I wasn't told, I had a lot of Bible teaching, which has been awesome. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have necessarily an understanding of the core things that I would always return to and test everything else against, you know? But now we're giving parents like, hey, here's these simple words, teach them to your children. If that's all you can do, have them memorize them. And the older they get, the more they will realize what those words mean, because you've now given them a category for truth, for what is true.
Well, and that's the, this comes back to that God speaks totalities. He speaks wholeness. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the risk if you don't do this stuff, if you don't start with something small that a child can get the child's hands around, you risk fragmenting all these things. And I mean, that's my memory of being in Sunday mm-hmm. school as a young child. We're being told about these quote unquote heroes of the Old Testament. You're like, well, these heroes, they're kind of idiots and they're doing terrible things. In what sense are they heroes at all? You know, David's an adulterer. Samson's all sorts of silly. And then even, you know, the best of them is someone like Gideon. And you're like, Gideon, get your act together. Like, if God can do this, he can do it. And so giving the totality of the Lord's Prayer, the Apostles' Creed, the Ten Commandments, it helps children find their way around in those stories. Each of those fragmented stories presents the whole that God speaks. But it's very difficult to see that without knowing the Apostles' Creed, say. So it's, you know, sometimes I was, I don't know if you remember this book that John Goldengaver wrote, Don't Bother With It. It's about, you know, did we need the books in the New Testament? And in there he has this point, he must mean something by this, but it feels quite silly that he says, well, if the Apostles' Creed summarizes the Bible, you don't even get to the second article until the New Testament. And it's like, wow, wrong. Like, no, that it's all the second article and third article about the Son and the Spirit are there in the Old Testament. And if they're not, the Christian faith is false.
I like it. I really like the spicy Todd. So bring me more spice, Todd.
Sorry, I try to be careful about Golden Gate. I know that he means very well, but it did upset me very deeply.
Did it upset you very deeply? I can't tell. But for real, I do remember I've read a good amount of Golden Gate. I don't think I've read that portion. Mm-hmm. But there was many moons ago that I was actually a biblical studies guy and read a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, some of it, man. One of my favorite silly examples, I guess while I'm being whiny, is evangelical commentaries on 1 Corinthians 8:6, Paul's adaptation of the Shema, that you have one God and one Lord Jesus Christ. And you'll see in all of these commentaries, they will either say it in the very text or they have a footnote. They're like, hey, by the way, Paul isn't saying that Jesus is God here. He's just using Lord as like, sir. And you're like, that, I'm sorry, that's really silly. He changed the confession of the Hebrew people. Of course he's saying Jesus is God. And that's the great blessing of reading the old dead lads when they comment on the Bible. They're not afraid of any of that stuff. You're like, hey, turns out the Bible is written by God and it's about God. And it gives you God. How cool is that? I mean, the Bible's amazing.
Todd, I love your passion for the Bible. It comes through in all the stuff you do. I think it's awesome. Now, a question for you all, both of you, is as you're working on a book and a series like this, who are your greatest influences or resources for the sort of like intellectual world that you're trying to cultivate and create? Todd, I imagine Luther's going to be one of those, so I want to hear more about Luther and how he impacts it. Natasha, I'd love to hear from you and your perspective. Who are the resources or the mentors or the ideas that are really pushing you?
You want to say first, Tasha?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how to answer that question from an artistic point of view, because I know Todd and I both are kind of involved in the, you know, theological layout of the page and Todd, the greater, you know, structure. But for me, I'm thinking artistically, what has helped guide me. I'll tell you one thing that's been very big is definitely iconography, but also, and definitely Ivan Durrell, please go look, just type in his name into Google, you know, you'll be amazed. But another one is actually, old historic paintings and how the masters have created a scene, and what draws your eye, and where does your eye start, and then where does it move to? And then another one is kind of some old-fashioned way of doing side-scroller gaming, where you have, like, this platform doesn't move, the platform behind it kind of moves slowly, and then the closer the platforms are in front of you, the quicker the image goes by. You have this kind of like paper layering effect. So in the closest, you know, to you, it's dark and silhouetted and close, and then it gets closer and closer. And so you're using color and warmth and coldness to like direct your eye on the page. And so kind of like hooking that in with another place I look to is also like graphic novels and comic books, because they're so good at drawing your eye to certain things, or using line art to tell you something. Even though you can't portray sound, you're getting the feeling of sound, you know, things like that. And they're really good at like what makes a villain and what makes a hero and why, you know, their placement on the page makes them look more ominous, things like that. So kind of pulling that all together and then being like, okay, how do I feed the theology that we're trying to communicate through all that? Where like where Jesus is on the page is telling you something about him, and the people who are mocking and accusing him, you know, like I'm thinking of an Apostles' Creed, the page for suffered under Pontius Pilate. You have these like black silhouettes of people wringing their fists and yelling at him. And then your eye is just drawn way up to Jesus, and Pilate's washing his hands, and Jesus is looking down sorrowfully, and you're seeing the side of his face rather than his face full on, you know, and you don't know that all this thought's necessarily gone into this. All you know is where your eye is drawn and then where it travels to after, you know? So I would say those are some of my, my inspirations when I put together kind of nerdy.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, a huge thing for this, yeah, is Luther stuff. Luther, I don't know. I know people that aren't from the Lutheran tradition, they have these doubts about, well, how can one tradition be built on one guy so much? And it's a fair criticism in many ways, but the dude really, he is a unique talent. And one of the things that he's really able to do in a masterful way is stretch the spectrum of learning, where, you know, he can go and do some pretty nerdy things with Neoplatonism and some syllogisms and embarrass some really smart people. I mean, he makes these weird, I think I've said this before to you, Jordan, that he makes these weird jokes about Platonic categories, like at they're, he's drinking with his students and his professor buddies, and I can't even quite keep up with what these jokes are that he does. But anyway, I mean, he just knows this stuff so well. But he really understands his audience. He understands you don't go and do that with kids. And that's the really fun thing to see in his preaching, is behind his preaching are these really big concepts that, that he's doing with the Bible or uniting. You know, he has this statement about the man on the cross is the God who made the world, or the man who made the world is the God on the cross. Like these really wonderful ways of simply holding together really difficult ideas about the Trinity and the hypostatic union. And he's just so good at it. And that's the small catechism, which is a commentary on the catechism of the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, and the Lord's Prayer. He's so masterful at bringing really tight Bible passages to illuminate these things. And the thing's only like 4,000 words. Nobody comes close to what he's doing there. And there really is an openness that even if you're not Lutheran, you can go look at the small catechism. There might be, basically all of it, you're going to be like, hey, this is great. I actually talked to a hardcore Reformed guy the other day who's in Holland. And he's like, yeah, that's what I use with my kids. Because it's way better than Westminster, because Westminster's so big. But that's, yeah, that this project really started with the small catechism, thinking about, because the small catechism wedded these words with images. And so we're thinking about, what are the images that will delight a child? How can they grow into these images? And And the Small Catechism doesn't drain the meaning of all these passages. So it's again thinking, you know, where do you start? Where will you go next? So you see slightly different styles with Ben Myers and Harold Senkbeil, where Ben just has a curiosity that's unrivaled and a way to put those things in a pithy fashion. And it helps that he used the story. You know, the Apostles' Creed is the most story-based of these books. And so his ability to just use poignant questions to point you down some small path that's really a very big path was great. And how, with the Lord's Prayer and the Ten Commandments, you really see sort of the life of worship come through in what he's up to. That was the big question in his mind. How do we talk about the Lord's Prayer without being like we're cutting up the Lord's Prayer on the table? But this is still something you can pray. But yeah, true to form, Luther is probably the big influence here. You know, we went and looked at other pieces of the great tradition for help too. Other folks that do this concrete personal stuff really well. And I mean, like the Ten Commandments, this idea that each commandment protects a gift. That was an insight given by John Kleinig, who's an Australian theologian. And it's an amazing insight. I've not seen somebody talk about it that way before. But it presents the Ten Commandments so that everybody is like, oh, let's do this again. Because the Ten Commandments, it's not something that people are super excited about talking about. Somebody here at work actually said, when she used to help out with the kids at church, that the volunteers were like, let's not do not commit adultery. Because they were worried about some of the kids here, their parents are divorced because of adultery. And that's the thing that's striking about all these things. It brings up really hard conversations.
So when I think about the Catechism and its use, or these volumes and their use, is there a sense in which we as adults outgrow some of this material? I mean, I know what the answer to that is, but tease it out for me a little bit. Give me an explanation. Help me to understand how it is that even small, simple resources like this can continue to develop and encourage and grow people like me, or people who are even greater and older in the faith.
No, that's a great question. I mean, of course you don't outgrow these things. I mean, the Apostles' Creed is the baptismal faith. This is, so as Ben Myers says in his Christian Essentials book, to leave the Apostles' Creed is to leave the faith behind. You always stay there. This is, you're just finding new ways to say it, new depths. It looks like a big thing, but there's a great quote, Gregory the Great. He talks about the Bible as this mysterious water that is deep enough to drown an elephant and shallow enough for lambs to drink. And that really is the truth. You know, people that want to be sophistic and clever, you can use the Bible to drown them. I mean, Jesus does it, right? Where he's, what was it? Mark 13. Is it Mark 13? Where Jesus is like, well, you Sadducees, don't you see you're wrong because you don't know the power of the Bible and that that the resurrection is true. Haven't you heard in the Torah that God says, I am the God of the living? It's just so wonderful, so simple, and just absolutely devastating. And then you can go and take small Bible verses and give them to children. But this is a difficulty, I think, with parenting and with kids, that when there's such a familiarity with these texts, we can tend to despise what's familiar. And I think that's part of the great gift of Tasha's art, is it brings a wonder to what's going on. And I think that's just a thing that we have to constantly be vigilant against. That these things, they're familiar truths, but man, are they crazy. I mean, the one that I always think of is he descended into hell. That God went all the way to where utter loneliness and death is. And now, in any place of loneliness and death, God is there. Loneliness is no more. And that's a really wild and wonderful thing. But and this is another thing that I've seen Luther do in his preaching, that he takes these common things and opens them up to say, how crazy is it? He's like, he gets cranky at the end of his life in some of his sermons with the way that people are living. He'll say, like, You people live like pigs. You lift your, you keep your eyes in the dirt and in your trough and in your beer. But you, in baptism, are children of the ascension. Lift up your eyes. That's where you live, is there in the heavens. That's where you're seated with God's word and with God and all the angels. And so I think there's, and children will draw that out. They draw out the craziness of this stuff, and they'll make connections that you never will, because they're so simple and not anxious about looking silly with the connections that they make.
So remind me, what are the upcoming volumes in this series? Do you have a bunch planned? What are you working on with it? What's next? What are the cool characters that are being involved? All that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. In September, we have our board book coming out, which is Who is Our King? It's a little book, even small for a board book. I don't know, maybe six spreads. And it's the animals in the different places that Jesus is. So we have like Jesus being born, and there are all these animals. Jesus is a 12-year-old boy in the temple, and there are all these animals at the Sermon on the Mount, crucifixion, resurrection. And that was a really fun little project. Very simple text. It's just sort of a simple Chalcedonian thing. But Tasha really made it very fun with all the animals. And there are new animals to find. Frederico the snail, Cannonball the spider. Who else am I forgetting? Focat is there, of course.
The bat.
Well, the bat, but he's not on everything. So the sixth kind.
Yeah.
Fat Cat, Focat, Wormy, Frederico, Cannonball. I am forgetting someone.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway, there's another. And then right now, Tasha's...
Oh, the mouse.
The mouse. Donuts. Donuts the mouse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then Tasha's working on morning prayer, evening prayer, which, how to describe this. So it's a book. You look at it like this. The spine is in your left hand, and it says morning prayer. And then you flip it around. The spine remains in your left hand. And instead of the text being upside down, it'll say evening prayer. And so Tasha's drawing these two families from the east and the west, and they meet in the middle. And it just goes through a very simple prayer. And that one is really fun. Now Tasha doesn't have any bounds. Doesn't have to worry about what does the Bible say. She can just have so much fun. But maybe you want
to see more. Oh my gosh, I get to draw like cities and modern day clothing. And I don't have to stress over who's allowed in what section of the temple, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that one's really fun.
Well, this has been great. I've had a ton of fun with you all. I mean, I think if you're listening, you can tell that both Todd and Natasha are awesome. And so you should go purchase their books and support them just because they're awesome. But also, these are great resources. So sometimes we have people on the podcast, we're talking about really high-tech, specific minutiae or monographs that are really important, and they're extremely valuable in their own right. But that's not for everybody's ability level. Whereas these books are for everyone. Everybody can benefit from these books. So I encourage you to go find a couple of them, get one in time for, you know, they released the Easter volume. I don't remember how long ago it was, but there's an Easter volume, the King of Easter, I think it's called. You can go get that just in time for Easter now, if you're listening to this right when it drops anyway. Maybe you're listening to it a year from now, right before Easter again, and so it's relevant. Either way, you can get all these volumes. I mean, I love the ones on the Apostles' Creed, Ten Commandments. I mean, I think it's just awesome. So go support what they're doing. I think they have the right heart and the right posture behind it. And I think it's just fabulous. So thanks, Todd and Natasha, for doing this. I really appreciate all your work in this. And everybody's been tuning in. Thanks for listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you all soon.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.